Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and today's episode is an interview with filmmaker Ed McCarthy. Now, Ed's short film, They Fall Fast, won the Programmer's Prize at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2018. And it's one of those films that is so memorable and so impactful that I can tell you staff and people who saw it 2 years ago still talk about it. Which is kind of the true test of a film, right? If you remember it a couple years later, clearly it had an impact. And if you want to watch it right now, you can. Just go to Amazon Prime Video and look up Discover Indie Film. There you're going to see the companion series to this podcast. And in Season 2, Episode 3, you're going to see They Fall Fast paired with another great film called Shark Week. So I highly recommend that you do that and watch the film. But you know what? I don't think there's any spoilers in this interview, so feel free to just keep on listening. All right, after the interview, I'll give you a bunch of links and things to look up. But for now, let's talk to Ed.
How do I make a long story short?
Yeah, your origin story.
Yeah, my origin story. I started in a lab. No, I mean, like anyone, you grow up watching TV and film. And I grew up on Long Island. I was born in Queens, raised in Long Island. And I was the youngest of four boys. So we didn't go to many movies growing because, you know, movies even then were expensive for a family of six. But I do remember going to things like Superman and E.T. But for, like, those movies were very impressionable, obviously. But what made more of an impression for me was watching television. You know, it was with my parents. And we had our shows as a family and our shows I watched with Mom, the shows I watched with Dad. You know, with Mom, it was usually soap operas, you know, Knott's Landing, Falcon Crest, things
that. The golden era.
Yeah, nighttime. Exactly. Nighttime soaps. And my dad was more like comedies. I remember Cheers.
Taxi.
Things like that. So through them and through the communal experience, that's when I appreciated the television as a medium. But you also, growing up thousands and thousands of miles away from Los Angeles, that's not a career. Like, I didn't pay attention to credits. Right. I didn't think of that. So I went to I went to college and got my degree in English education and became a high school English teacher straight out of college. But I guess because I love stories, you know, not because.
And had you been a writer? Had you been writing?
I had. I was toying with majoring in creative writing for a little bit. And in college, I was at NYU, and at college I took some playwriting courses, and I was always complimented regarding my, you know, one-act plays at that point. And I entered some kind of contest for NYU students, and it was three one-act plays were going to be picked and directed by, you know, I think graduate students who were studying theater. And, you know, I was one of the three selected. And so they made this big kind of thing. You know, it was like a whole weekend on one of the you know, small theaters in New York City. And everyone said they really liked the play, but I felt like a fraud because I felt like I was making stuff up. Like, I'm like 19 years old, and what do I know about life kind of thing.
Really? So instead of being like, yeah, I'm going to be a playwright, you thought you had a little bit of imposter syndrome?
I was literally going to say, yeah, you know, it's like imposter. I felt like someone's going to, person would point me out and be like, that you made all that up. And I'm like, yeah, I did.
But you're supposed to.
I know. And that's the disconnect there. So I felt, you know, I just felt like I didn't have life experience. In retrospect, like, I didn't know what I was feeling at the time. I just felt uncomfortable and whatnot. But I just feel like, you know, life experience really helps a person in their writing. But I taught for several years, and then, you know, I got an MFA in creative writing from there.
Okay,
Focusing on
before or after you were teaching?
After, yeah. After, so I left this profession and got it. I realized I really wanted to. I was going to turn into. I was a well-liked teacher for a while while I was teaching, but I was going to turn into that middle-aged teacher that everyone hated because it's very hard to be a teacher. You know, you have to give so much of yourself, you know. And I realized I wanted to create story, not write story. Mm-hmm. Write story, not teach story, I should say. So I got my MFA in creative writing, focusing on fiction and screenwriting. And my goal is to be a TV writer, like I said, growing up to television. So that's when I moved to Los Angeles. I've been here for about 8 years. And I just studied.
After the MFA, or you got the MFA?
Yeah,
I got
my MFA, and then I moved out here. And, you know, I've had jobs in post-production. I've had jobs in development. I've had jobs In terms of producing, line producing. I've had jobs as a writer assistant in TV shows.
Which is the way in,
right. I just got off a gig last week as a writer assistant. I'm up for a gig for a writer assistant for another show. Hopefully I'll find out. I can find it any day now. And that hopefully will segue into an actual writer's position in a room. But I also want to make my own stuff. So
yeah, so you got the bug to direct?
Yeah, I first wrote They Fall Fast, or wrote the short. And at first I wasn't sure if I was going to direct it, but I figured, why not? You know, I wanted to direct at some point, even though I see myself as a writer primarily. So I'm like, why not? You know, just let's do it. And
that was the first one.
That was my, So
I'm like, not even just like a little assignment.
No, not even like a,
yeah. Cause you were doing a pure writing program.
Yeah. So my MFA was all writing.
Yeah.
So, and at that point I've been on enough sets that, you know, being on a set's not foreign to me. The department heads and each crew position, what each crew member does, that wasn't a foreign concept. So, I was comfortable on sets.
You wrote They Fall Fast and you looked at it and said, you know, based on the logistics and the way it's written. Mm-hmm.
It's two person. It's for at least half of it. They're, you know, it's a technical stunt. So, you know, but they're not moving. I don't have to worry about blocking as much as I do about logistics of this falling. And
yeah, you don't have car mounts. So
the most challenging part was a walk and talk. Actually, that is the only part of the film that I feel like the flow is broken up a little bit more than I'd want it to be.
I would disagree. Yeah, I don't have any problem with your flow.
I love it. There was like really three locations, which is the parking lot with the car, the trail where they're walking, and then the actual quicksand. And then we repeat the parking lot and the trail on the way back.
It shows how well your story structure is.
Yeah, I mean, I felt confident enough in the script, and I had actors that I felt really comfortable with, and I feel like it's about finding the DP was the big piece of the puzzle, and I found someone. Her name is Rose, who's phenomenal. I'd work with her again in a heartbeat. She really cares about, you know, what's on the page and what I wanted to see as a director, and then she's like, okay. You know, you have to trust the DP. I trust every person, you know, to find, I don't have the vocabulary to be like, these are the specific lenses I want. But I don't need that vocabulary. I came to realize because you have to trust people to be experts in their field. So as long as I could articulate the kind of thing I want to see and how wide or
tight, and the emotions, you know,
and
the emotions
and what I'm going after, they have a vocabulary and the technique.
And then are you watching on the monitor anyway?
And you're seeing, and
you can say, well, that one I'm not super, but
yeah,
it sounds village. Like you were really happy with what you were seeing.
Absolutely. We had a video village, a very small one, cause though it's a tight, you know, production, I also want it to be a right production, right? Done correctly. So yeah, we definitely had, you know, we did, with Alexa, cameras, we had a video village, you know, we had, I think the crew was about 25.
It was really good with the
camera department.
But that's partially also because of your work and you knew people.
Yeah,
you could
we
trust
knew people. Yeah, and we also got a really good line producer, this guy Sam, who really helped, you know, get a first AD for me that was outstanding. And you know, like I said, trust everyone in their roles. We did have two cameras for the stunt. One camera for. It was a 2-day shoot. So day one was, you know, the trail, the parking lot and all that stuff. Day two was 100% the quicksand stunt. And we got a little bit of B-roll footage that day. So for day two, we had two cameras. So.
Right, which is smart because you're doubling your coverage right there.
Yeah, exactly. And we knew the morning was going to be devoted in getting the character Carlos's coverage. And then after lunch, we got Eileen's coverage. And we just knew that sequence was going to make or break the short. And we wanted, you know, I've also worked in post-production and a lot of editors, you know, the problem is they don't have enough coverage. And so I wanted to make sure that quicksand scene we had as much coverage as
possible. I mean, there's nothing first film. It might have been your first directing, but it doesn't sound like anything was first time-ish because you did all the right things and you created the situation to succeed by doing it the right way.
If you set yourself up for success. And I think going into something, there's a difference between going into something blind versus going into something unaware. And if you do your research and you're aware of every stage of the process and what everybody does, then, you might be going into a situation slightly blind, but you're not going into it.
Yeah. And you weren't blind to anything because you had experience at the writing stage and the post-production stage, and you'd been on set. So you really were familiar with everything.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Especially that post stage, because that's where a lot of people find out they've messed up.
Yeah. And my editor, Ruth, who's also a dear friend of mine, I made it better. I feel, I felt very confident in the script. I felt confident in my ability, as a producer and as a director, even though it was my first time. But any position, they make it better. The DP, Rose, she made it better.
To compliment you, they couldn't have made it better if you hadn't done such great work. And really, a director's job is often to support their whole team and make sure everyone's doing their best. So
thank you. Yeah, I agree with the director needs to set the tone and allow people to breathing room to do their job.
And your performances are superb.
Yeah, Mim and Victor, they are outstanding. Yeah, we auditioned. Rick Pagano, the casting director, who I worked with on other stuff, he's really a seasoned casting director, Emmy nominated, and he read the short, and he's like, I like this. I want to cast this for you. And I'm like, for real? And he goes, yeah. I'm like, all right, I won't turn that down. So we did 2 days of casting, in a Santa Monica office, and, Mim, the actress who played Eileen, was literally the first person who auditioned, over 2 days. But of course, you have to see everyone. But she
saw 30, 40 more.
Yeah. And she was obviously, from the first audition, on the top of the list. But then it's about picking who would be the two, though she was always on the top of the list. It's
right. Who played well with
right,
her.
Right. Who would play well with, whoever we wanted for Carlos and, because they need to be, they're two characters who are very contrasting and totally different from each other, but they still need to be complementary. So we felt like, Carlos has a little bit of comedic lightness to him, and Eileen had, her circumstances in life are arguably worse than Carlos's. So she needed to be a little bit more, bitter is not the right word, but a little bit more maybe jaded, a sharp edge.
Jaded, overwhelmed. Yeah. She's overwhelmed.
Yeah. So she has a very jaded and sharp edge to her, but not, but there's still, she has like biting one-liners that there's still humor and there's still life to her. So that was a very complicated, I felt,
character. Yeah. Well, on the page, there was a lot of depth. Mm. A lot of depth on the page, and then she didn't let you down at all. She made it all very much alive.
Oh, no. The first time I saw the quicksand sequence, in the first cut that Ruth did, I got teary-eyed, and I, don't want to be like, I wrote it, so obviously I knew what was going to happen. But even when, she was sinking and he sank, even I was like, had that like, wow, like, am I... are they going to come up, which is obviously what I want the audience to feel. So, during that process, a couple months of posts, because everyone's working on, scraping time together off from their free time. When you get deep into weeds, you always feel uncertain. So for me, whenever I was watching a cut and I just didn't feel like, oh, is this working anymore? I always go back to that first cut. And I'm like, how did I feel? And that is what I always you had to hold on to. Because after the 11th, 12th time seeing something, it's no longer fresh. So you have to remember what was it like that fresh, the first time when it was. That quicksand sequence was probably the thing that changed the least in the editing process. Once we had the first or second cut down, that one we changed, obviously we added a little bit and trimmed dialogue here and there. That quicksand sequence was, I just always went back to how I felt the first time.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
And the inspiration for the story before I turned on the mics, you and I were talking actually about when your parents are ailing and things. So I guess you do have insight into caretaking.
I do. The character of Eileen is based on my mom, who I actually gave. My mom's name was Eileen, and she has since passed. You know, but I did write this actually after my dad passed away. Mm-hmm. You know, so if people have not seen the short, you should stop right now and go watch it.
Yes.
And then come back to, so you know what I'm talking about. But briefly, the character of Eileen is dealing with, you know, her husband is at the very last stages of pancreatic cancer. So it's a, and her, she, he will literally be coming home the next day.
For
end of life care. So, you know, I know when my dad passed away and talking to my mom about, you know, her life, she grew up in a generation that, you know, women didn't have the choices, you know, that they should have had. You know, she was the oldest of three, but the other two were boys. So she always talked about, you know, she was really strong in math and wanted to be a businesswoman, had like an internship in high school, I think it was, with an accounting office. And she really wanted to go that route. But, you know, they were like, no, you get a job and you be a caretaker and you be, you know, a mother.
Yeah. In that era, a woman was expected.
Yeah. To
be a full-time parent.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not seen as potential like breadwinner or potential, you know, business, you know, owner or anything like that. Or just even working in a business unless you're a secretary type of thing. So, and telling, you know, as a kid, they're just mom. You know, as an adult, you get to know them on a, you know, and hopefully on a different level. And it becomes more about learning, you know, who she was before mom, you know. And so I realized all these, the life she could have had if she didn't get married and, you know, and not that she could have had, maybe she didn't. But now that my dad had died, you know, who is she now? And, you know, reinventing herself kind of a thing. So that was the kind of inspiration for the Eileen character, someone who has primarily been defined by wife and mother. And now that her, you know, husband is, you know, near the end of his life, and also her daughter is at the end of her college education. Yeah. Those roles as wife and mother, those roles are kind of blurred or about to be non-existent.
Yeah.
So who am I?
And the role of caretaker, because she's been pink cancer is not fast.
It is not, and it is, and it becomes all-consuming. So
which clearly, well, obviously explains why it's so well written, because there's so much there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And it's how to get all that there in the 17 pages of the script.
Were you tempted to make it longer?
It was. Actually, the script was longer. And the first cut, I mean, the cut right now is about 12 minutes. The first cut, I forget exactly how long, but it was north of 15 minutes. It's because, you know, like anything, sometimes things worked at the script level and you realize, you know, with the footage you have, you're like, you know what, this joke really worked on the page. It feels, you know, it's not matching the tone that the footage we're seeing here.
You are describing the best quality of editing, which is where you recognize the stuff you don't need because a lot of people don't.
Yeah. And I think that's the fault too. Like some shorts are far too long because, you know, people are too precious, or movies are far too long. It doesn't have to be short. But we realized, wow, this was a great discussion on the page. When they're walking, we get a little bit more about how they met on the internet and things like that. So there's a discussion there that it just felt like, you know, we don't need this. And there were jokes in there. And I found that after I showed it to a couple of people, they didn't dislike it, but they wanted to get to the mystery of where are they going was much more captivating, you know, than some of the jokes that they were making. So I'm like, okay, let's get to the quicksand faster. And so that was my goal.
Which really shows why, I mean, you weren't a kid making a film in his early 20s, but it's such mature filmmaking to see what the heart of the matter is and to get to it more efficiently. Mm. Believe me, that's when people give me stuff to look at, the number one note is get to it faster.
Yeah. And I think that's the complicated thing is when you're a writer, slash director and slash producer, you have to remember where you are in the moment of that. So when I'm a writer, that's all I care about. When I'm directing, I just want to get the best coverage and to get best performances I can. And when you're an editor or working with the editor, I should say, none of that kind of, it matters, but yeah, I have to remember I'm not the writer.
It becomes you're being loyal to the material, but also to an audience.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's truly, people say editing is the last rewrite, and it's completely true. And you need to divorce yourself from the writer that you were when you created the script, or the director you were when you were getting the coverage and footage. Because there are some shots I want to be precious to it. And I really like that reaction. But yeah, I mean, you need to create the story with the footage you have then at that point. Not what was written on the page. So,
yeah. Yeah. And it is that last read. Well, that's why it came out so well. And then you finished it. I would imagine the year before I saw it.
Yeah. So yeah, like anything, it's a process. It's a slow thing of, once I had it, I wrote it fairly quickly. The first draft came out actually in 2 days, and then, with notes and stuff. So, but then it became like sitting on a shelf, not because I didn't want to do anything, but, even indie stuff and shoestring budget stuff, there's still a budget
And you decided to direct it pretty soon after writing it?
Yeah, for some reason I felt, maybe because discussing my mom earlier, I felt a certain closeness to this that if someone was going to screw it up, I wanted it to be me, kind of a thing.
So humble.
Yeah. It's like,
But the truth is, what you did is you made it wonderful. So.
Thank you. And I'm super proud of it and all the work everyone did, as part of it. But yeah, this production company called Gumption Pictures, they have an indie spirit like you do and an artist spirit and they wanted to help bring it to life. I'm thankful to them for doing so.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So they did it and in conjunction with my buddy who I produced it with, Miguel, and his production company, Tangible Matter, we were able to get it done and rent all the equipment, pay the crew. I'm also... just because it's indie and low budget doesn't mean it should be free. I have that kind of mentality. So I definitely, if I was going to do it, I wanted to make sure people, got some payment out of this, and it got paid for their couple of days of work.
Yeah, I know it's impossible to say, but I wouldn't be surprised if that pay people for their time ethos, even if it wasn't much, is another reason for the quality because, the day of, the people doing it as a favor.
Yeah, if it's a favor, it's...
They have to really be a close friend to give their best.
And you can only phone in a few favors, I feel like. Some people called me in for favors, and I'm happy to do it, if I really believe in the person or friends with the person or the material. But I don't like asking for favors like that because it is free work. It's a different thing if someone is just starting out and they just got out of school and they're looking for credits and looking to build a network. And so they might be free labor for some of their friends' stuff and things like that. That's the way that it goes. But I do believe that it's a double-edged sword because a lot of this stuff that we watch and like, and especially in the indie world, wouldn't exist if there weren't favors called in and
true,
labor.
True. But your film is not a bunch of kids.
No, it is not. It's all together. Pros. They're all pros. My DP came from AFI. The editor I use has been editing, Ruth, she's a good friend. She's been editing for years and years and years. And the line producer, Sam, he's done a bunch of producing, and UPM and line producing stuff of shorts. So, definitely the people used on crew are not amateurs, and if you will pay them, and even if it's, not even like just barely scale, we were SAG, but we weren't union below the line kind of stuff. But, actually we were only SAG.
That tends to be the case.
That tends to be the case. Yes. Yeah.
And so now, after you started your festival run, mm-hmm. Did you have a really good one?
A good festival run?
I guess that's a leading question.
Because, it is.
My expectation is that that you should have had a wonderful festival run.
I am very happy now that it literally had its last festival about 3 weeks ago. And so looking back, I am happy with this festival run. Going into it, you know, when you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, you're very happy with the work and you expect, you know, to have a great festival run and but there's so many shorts out there and so many, you know, limited spots in these festivals. It got rejected a lot. Yes, it was, I don't know the exact numbers, but yeah, it got, and I did get nice notes from, you know, Austin Film Festival saying it made it, you know, to I think the last round before it got cut. And even Sundance gave me a nice note. And it didn't feel like a generic note saying, hey, we really like this. And it was like, I forget, there was one or two sentences that made it feel like, oh, this is not like, you know, this is not generic.
It's not the form letter.
Yeah. So there were a couple other, you know, reputable ones that, you know, and by reputable, I mean just known, that I got notes about, you know, it making it far into the process. But yeah, Sherman Oaks was its first film festival.
Oh, was it the first?
Yeah, Sherman Oaks was its premiere, which is great because I live in Sherman Oaks.
See, I had no darn idea that...
Yeah, I'll be honest. I was going through a little bit of a, you know, artist dark space for a little bit because I think it was about 6 or 7 months of rejections at that point. Hey, made it really far. But I was just like, I don't know what's going on. So when I got that email from Sherman Oaks, I was like, finally, someone likes it. And it's
I'm
validation.
Pumping my fist right now. Because it's interesting because I've heard from other filmmakers who've come in for a podcast. Sometimes they say like, I wasn't getting in anywhere. And then I got in to Sherman Oaks or Film Invasion. And then the yeses started coming.
Yeah, and it was.
And I wonder if there is like, some festivals need, I'll be crude and say the cherry has to be popped at some point.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And because after that, it then got in, it's like had about 4 or 5 festivals.
And it really is very good. It's, I know a filmmaker she's very talented and she was very jaded about the festival process and rejections. And then she actually ended up on a jury for a festival. And then she started posting on Facebook. I just want everyone to know that when they tell you they love your film but don't have space for it, they mean it.
Yeah. I totally, you know, it's funny because the festival and in your programmer, so, you know, you might hear some of this stuff too. A lot of it's like people say you need to know the programmer and I didn't know you until beforehand, so that's obviously not the case. But, you know, there is also a numbers game. It's just like, you know, they're getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of submissions and shorts, you know, are easier to make than features, you know, because they take less time. And so I would imagine that some of these festivals are getting a lot more shorts than maybe features.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine how many Sundance and, you know, the biggies receive. I've never seen the number, but yeah, I heard once there's a few thousand made per year. And who's not going to apply to Sundance?
Exactly. And it's absolutely. And maybe if someone got into a Sundance lab or something, they have a leg up.
They're locked in.
Yeah. So,
but honestly, I went to Sundance like 10 years in a row back in the 90s and the shorts aren't great. I never understood their process.
Right. And there's some festival, every festival you go to, you see some shorts and you're like, and sometimes you're like, oh, I don't respond to it, but I get it. And sometimes you're like, what? Okay, what happened there? And sometimes I don't want to be a skeptic or bitter, but sometimes you're like, is this for some film festivals, a money grab? Because sometimes you're like, they're not even watching it because, you know, if you are Vimeo where you have to submit via, Film Freeway, not without a box anymore, but, you know, you have to upload your Vimeo with your password, the link, and you can see how many times your
you
thing
can,
is.
You can, but you know what? We ran an experiment.
Really?
A filmmaker, she posted on Facebook, you know, that I don't think they're watching. And I said, hey, if you want, she was through without a box. She was a without a box user back when you had a choice. And so I said, here, I'll make you a judge. You watch your film and you go back to Vimeo and see if your number went up. And she watched the whole thing and her number didn't go up.
Really?
I wonder what that is. Actually, it could be the way it's embedded without a box. I don't know. We didn't test it with Film Freeway.
Yeah.
But I thought it was very interesting that...
That is interesting. That actually, you know...
she tested it for us.
That makes me feel better, yes. Because you can see, you know, Vimeo, the source, and who sees it directly from Vimeo, and then you can see without a box.
Yeah.
And you see, so the numbers were not adding up for me, which made me think that...
they weren't watching.
Some weren't even watching.
I think
it.
They probably... Well, you know, who knows?
Yeah,
I can't speak
absolutely.
For other festivals,
yeah.
And Lord knows. But I do know also from our end, the festival end, sometimes you're forced, instead of watching it embedded in Film Freeway, it says, can only be viewed on Vimeo.
Oh.
And then you have to click and it opens
not
another window.
Oh, okay.
And I wonder if that's someone who's caught on that if they want to see how much it's been watched.
That they somehow
you gotta
are able
pull
to.
Pull them right into the page.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if embeds work for the stats.
Yeah.
They should.
They should, theoretically. And sometimes they do. So sometimes, because this will tell me the video source is without a box,
yeah.
as opposed to, or Film Freeway.
Should run that test again.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually, it makes me feel better because, you know, that was, you know, one of the things that made me feel a little bit like disenchanted with the process.
Yeah.
It's like, you feel like you're submitting and, you know, submitting to 10 film festivals is going to cost, a few hundred, $200 to $300, $400.
Yeah, no, I know people who spent more on festival submissions than they did on the film.
No, that's totally accurate. And now, before doing this, you know, you work on productions and I see line budget items for film festivals and it makes total sense now. Because if you want your film to have a shot, you really need to play the numbers and try to submit to many film festivals.
It's like college, right? You apply to your top five schools
right.
and then you've got like 10 backup schools.
Right. Your reach, your safe, your safe schools, it's great. So yeah. So I'll be honest, the Sherman Oaks Film Festival was a great experience, because number one, it was validation, got accepted. It was the first film festival. It was literally in where I live, Sherman Oaks.
Yeah.
And so a lot of friends were able to come out and to see it and to...
Yeah, you had a nice audience. And I believe you were in a really good block.
Yeah, it was some really good stuff in that block. It was a nice, healthy block too, because of diversity and types of film plus time, total running time. Because there are some blocks I'm like, this is so long. This is so long.
I refuse to go over, I think, 40 minutes. 40, 45 is a cap. That's only if we get forced.
Mm-hmm.
If filmmakers are like, no, please let me get in
that time slot.
I can only attend Sunday at noon. And I'm like, fine, we'll add one more film. But yeah, because... Yeah, ideally, you'll just watch films for 30, 40 minutes and then talk about them for an hour.
Right. And I've been in, you know, film festivals that the block was 3 hours long.
Three?
Yeah.
I actually haven't heard. I've heard of the 90-minute block, like the feature-length block, and then I've heard, what's it? Someone called it like the lineup of doom, where they bring all the directors in front and they just stand and say, okay, wave.
Yeah.
And sometimes they let audience ask each person one question, or they just say, go down the line left to right and say your name, your film, and your budget.
Yeah, it was, budget. Ooh, that's
isn't that horrible?
That is a horrible question. Oh, I would not.
And who wouldn't lie?
I would plead the fifth on that one.
You should.
Yeah.
Whenever an audience member asks that during the Q&A, I always try to interrupt and go, you don't have to answer.
Okay, yeah. So that's like, I don't know if that's public knowledge.
Shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, yours is, I do, you know, before I critique anything, I think it's great that film festivals still have a Q&A for shorts programs and filmmakers, because often they are overlooked, I think, in the grand scheme of things for film festivals. But yours was the first one actually had first and only one where it was an individual Q&A.
Really? It was the only one?
It was the only one. Every other one they called the filmmakers up front, so there was like a panel of us. And
right. So your producer and your DP and your actor couldn't be with you.
No. Yeah. It was just me,
yeah.
just me. And so for those, one of them was just a line, like question, answer, question. So the questions were a little bit more general. Another one, other two I was part of, was more like, you know, general for about 10 minutes, like, and then any audience questions that you had for the filmmakers or a specific film, which I prefer that lineup, I think, because if you're an audience member and you really want to know something about a specific film, you, you know, that's the time to do it.
Yeah, and it allows everyone, because I always believe that question, other people have that question in their heads. It's generally.
Yeah, and it takes the extrovert to ask that question.
It does. It takes the one, it takes somebody to do it.
Yeah. I appreciated I do appreciate the one-on-one, and I think having a program.
And it was great to have. I know that Mim joined you.
Mim was joining me.
I can't remember who else was up there.
Yeah, it was just me and Mim.
Just you and Mim. Yeah, okay.
Miguel was there, my producer partner.
But he was shy.
Yeah, he a little bit. And he's like, you talk, you do the talking. And he's also Portuguese, so he's like, no, you talk. Yeah, so he's like, you're better at talking. And some of the other producers from Gumption were there. The DP couldn't make it because she was due to give birth any day there. So, yeah, she's like,
She had a good excuse.
Yeah, she goes, I will join the next one, and she did. And the editor was there and some friends and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a really good bunch. And the number of, you know, the seats, in terms of the number of seats, it was really good. It was big and intimate at the same time, you know?
Yeah. That happens to be, well, I'm glad that we were your first, we were your premiere, and you had a good experience.
Thanks for being gentle.
And we set you up for the expectation that you would get to sit there alone over and over.
Yeah. But it's good. I mean, that's the thing with people making shorts is they want to prove themselves so they can make something else. For me, I'm, like I said, I see myself as a writer. So I want people to say, hey, he can look what he could do with character and dialogue in 12
minutes.
Right.
So you, for you, it was a bit of a calling card as a writer, but also as a director. Do you think you'll want to direct more? Because you should. I really think you should.
There's an idea that comes to me, and I usually start the writing, and I don't think of the directing part. For They Fall Fast, very quickly, I started seeing it, so that's why I'm like, let me try to direct it. And I haven't really thought of that until I'm just started I'm not even writing the script yet. It's just more an outline stage, but a feature, very small indie, primarily two person, but you know, a few other character feature, some visually is coming to me a lot more like They Fall Fast did. So this one, I do think I would want to direct, with the same DP. I already talked to Rose, but emailed Rose, and we're like, want to get together soon, you know, in LA. That could mean 4 months from now.
Sure. But get coffee and say, exactly. Well, I've got another one.
Yeah. And this is what I have, you know, in mind. This is a feature that I definitely would like to try to do.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So
I won't ask you to give away what it's about, but I'm glad to hear that I'll see more from you.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'll make sure it's submitted to Sherman Oaks Film Festival.
Well,
yes,
absolutely.
I can't promise when, but
sometime in the 2020s. Isn't that hard to believe? It'll be in the 2020s.
That's
It'll
scary.
Be in the 20s. The roaring 20s are coming back.
They are. I can't. I do like jazz music.
And so the deadline for 2019 is passed. So what do you know?
So, yeah.
It's all about 2020.
It's all about 2020 now.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, no, we'll get our flapper outfits. And
I like it. I like that.
And do it up.
I'll do that, you know.
Well, so now I can throw in the spoiler that even though you didn't direct it, I ended up – I'm watching the stuff submitted to Sherman Oaks this year now. Buried in it.
But you're deep in. You're in the deep end right now.
I'm deep in. And by the way, just to, I guess it's me begging for empathy, but one reason why I just love films like yours so much is, you know, I have no idea what it does to a person emotionally to watch 4 or 5 bad ones in a row. You know, I mean, you know, a couple hundred films, they're not all going to be good. And then when you see something good, you know, you start to see yourself, oh my God, are we going to, you know, because everyone watches, and then you sort them on a spreadsheet based on the average grade and all that. And you're like, okay, are we going to be showing? God, that wasn't good enough to show. Am I going to have to show that?
Yeah.
So it really is nice to see quality films that are
Well made. And as a programmer, it must be nerve-wracking if you see like 5, 6, 7 bad ones in a row. You're like, what am I going to do?
Yeah. No, you literally – I start to panic. Yeah. I start to panic, and I start to think – everyone. But hopefully, you know, this is my 4th year doing it, so hopefully I'll calm the heck down. But anyway, so I saw a really innovative little sci-fi short. Mm. And then I saw your name on it.
Yeah.
And then of all things, I actually did in Film Freeway. It shows a little director bio. And I recognized your friend from who you brought with you to the mixer.
Yeah.
Well, I guess he was your producer on the Fall Fest.
So that's Miguel.
The mysterious Portuguese.
Yes, the Portuguese man. He's in Portugal right now visiting family. But yeah, Miguel, he's I consider him family, a friend you consider family type thing. And it's our goal to be, me write, he direct, because he is a director.
Yeah. Had you worked that way with him before? Or?
On some projects, but this is the one that, we had this idea that I had I had the characters and the clear arc for it. And it's also you gotta use what you have, and something that we could film in his apartment building in downtown Los Angeles, and make it look like something that is not just his apartment building in downtown Los Angeles. And we came up with, we both like dark, subject matter. Mm-hmm. And so we came up with this thing called The Program, which was essentially,
I mean, it's a dystopian future.
It's dystopian. There is an alien and post-apocalyptic, kind of, but the world isn't totally destroyed.
Yeah.
But it's after an alien invasion. But I didn't want it to be about, fighting aliens. And I also, similar to They Fall Fast, I guess I have a theme of, what's the point of living?
A little bit. I wasn't going to come right out with it, but I definitely see the connection and themes of people push to their limits emotionally.
Yeah. I want people, push to their limits, struggling, and try to figure out what's going to get me to tomorrow, what's going to get me to the next point. So this is it's basic counselor session where, a counselor needs to sign off on you entering the program. Obviously Westworld.
Yeah, you don't have to give away what the program is or anything.
Yeah, but I also like shows like Westworld and Humans, which just got off the air, which is about artificial intelligence.
I've heard I'm a huge Westworld fan, and I've heard I should watch Humans.
I love Humans. I think Humans and Westworld are both exploring the same theme, but in artificial, specifically with artificial intelligence and consciousness. But Humans is much more intimate, much more grounded. Okay. Westworld is very much,
pretty big.
It's big. The scope is huge. The world is huge. Humans is much more intimate. But it's always about the struggle to gain consciousness. So I'm like, what if that were reverse, a little bit? And humans had the ability to kind of take a step back from consciousness and mostly just feeling.
Right.
The thing that makes
a different type of giving up.
Yeah. 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 So it's like, I want to be part of this world, but I don't really want to be affected by it. And what if that were possible, kind of a thing. So those are the types of themes.
Right. And you wrote it for a...
So the Producers Guild of America has a contest. I think it's annual. I'm not 100% sure about that. But they did have it last summer, where you have 51 hours to write, direct, and edit a short film.
Which is an interesting amount of time. I guess it starts at noon on Friday, and you have to have it in by 3 on Monday or something.
Yeah, it was
like an extra 3 hours.
Yeah, almost like that. It started literally at a 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. They give you the assignment, and then you have Friday until 5 to upload the actual content.
Is the assignment specific, or it's just make a short of a certain length?
It is very specific. So they had to... it's based on a producer, their work. And so what you need to do is if you sign up in advance and you pay the submission fee. And so you have to kind of get your team together in advance. So we knew Miguel and I, that's where we're like, okay, what can we had, a DP editor or sound person. And I was talking before about free labor. One of the rules is this needs to be volunteer.
Right. So
one can be paid. And I think that's actually a fair rule, because it does level the playing field if someone has no money versus someone does have money.
Yeah, someone came in with a trust fund and was going to spend $50,000 in a weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So there I get it. And in some ways that made it easier, because it was like, hey, we can't pay you, but here's the link. We're doing it for this.
Yeah, we're not allowed to pay
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so you know. And so Miguel and I, we knew going into it, like, okay, we wanted to use his building. We used his apartment, some other areas in the building we could use. We had two actors. We're like, okay, we're going to make something with them. And so I knew going into probably some kind of therapy session would lend itself. And so at 2 o'clock, they gave the assignment, which is – they gave you – I'm trying to remember. They give you, like, three potential settings – and you must incorporate one. And for us, it was any kind of post-war era. So that's where the aliens came up. Okay,
really? So you were assigned post-war.
Yeah. So well, there was that. You could use literally a train station or I think a law firm office or a law or any office. So two are very physical. One is more backdrop. So we used the post-war. And that's where we said, okay, this is an alien invasion that happened.
And did you have any of those ideas, or did they all – you just started spitballing?
We just started
– at 2 o'clock.
Kind of Miguel and I spitball a little bit. And that's when there's a scene that – it opens where a character's running down a hallway, and then we see a spaceship, and we have a voiceover. So we're like, okay, you film that. Like Miguel and I were spitballing, and we're like, okay, I'm going to go write the script. But this will be the opening of a voiceover over her running down the hallway, slow-mo. We see an alien spaceship, some destruction. And you know, while you do that, I'm writing. So we
So you were writing while he was shooting that first idea. Yes, that's smart.
Yeah. So we needed to just use every minute. And since there'll be voiceover over the scene, we're fine. And we kind of talked about this will be like the voiceover because one of the other you had to use there were five props. You had to use three of them. One of them were eyeglasses, and one of them needed to have a very important story piece. So the reason this woman survived an alien invasion, you find out during a voiceover, is because she went home to get her eyeglasses. Instead of meeting her husband and kid at a restaurant that got destroyed. So we used three things, those props, other five. And the final thing were theme. And we had to explore one of two themes. And so this was, I think it was like public versus private self, your true nature. And so this is a woman who, you know, her true self was, she didn't want to be a wife. She didn't want to be a mother. She didn't want to be all these things that
right. Others. The fact that they were killed was almost.
Yeah, she was ready to leave them, you know. And like, I think she says a line is like, "I'm sad that I lost them, but I'm sad that they're gone, but only that they're gone in this way, because she wanted them to still be alive and living in the world, but she didn't want to. She didn't have that strong urge to be a mother that she thought she would, or be a wife that she thought she would."
So. Which is very human and very normal that no one is willing to admit.
I think so. I mean, like sometimes you have a dream, you want these things, and then you get it. You're like, oh, okay. That's maybe not as.
Well, and I'm at this stage where I know a lot of parents, and they some admit it. Some admit it, that the Facebook posts are a lie.
Facebook is a lie? Oh, my gosh.
Facebook posts. My child is the most precious. They're my heart and soul and the reason I get up in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's not like, oh, my God, when they go away to camp for a month, it's the best thing ever.
Right. I can be me, you know. I mean, I'm not a parent, so, you know, I don't understand that. But I understand it on a
yeah,
on a intellectual, part of a family. Yeah. I mean, the closest I have is I spent a few years teaching, and I spent 10 months being Mr. McCarthy, and then the summer happened, and then I had 2 months to find Ed.
When you talked about teaching, I thought of, you know, and how it you could tell you would become the teacher everyone hated, but yeah, because you have to. I mean, you are parenting other people's kids all day.
Yeah. Yeah.
As well as teaching, because the kids don't come in ready.
They
anymore.
Don't come in ready. Yeah. Some do, some don't. It's very much a mixed bag. And when you had at that time, I don't know what it is now, but a class of 34 students.
Yeah. I mean, you're teaching you're teaching humanity, not just the humanities.
Like,
right?
You're absolutely right. You'd have to be a model for how to behave, not just like, you know, this is what a topic sentence is. And based on this, Miguel and I are now turning the program into, hopefully we're developing into a TV show. So a pilot that those two characters in the short will be part of it, and their storyline is part of it, but it's much more of an ensemble piece where
world
building, about the aliens, the politics, you know, what led to this type of, you know, program being such a viable option. You know, so we're branching that out, and fingers crossed, you know, we can film it, you know, get some kind of budget together and film it at some point, you know.
Probably an hour.
Yeah, I see it as an hour long. So the script will be in the 50 to 60 page range. And
it's a cool concept.
Yeah.
And you must be having fun with it, all the places you can go.
I definitely, yeah.
I'll give you full credit. It's completely original. We've had countless, I can't name how many alien invasion films we've had, but it's never been done that way.
Yeah, I the alien invasion stuff is always like it's about us versus the aliens. Yeah.
And then we figure out that Achilles heel right. Where we win.
Exactly. And you know, obviously if there's going to be an alien invasion, that needs to be a very substantial narrative, you know, thread. But I don't want it to be about that. It's kind of nihilistic and it's kind of government control. You know, it is a little bit of today, you know, the 1%, the upper echelon of wealth owning so much and controlling as a result of that, controlling so much. So that is what the fundamentals behind the program are, you know, and why it was created and stuff. And, you know, there's, you know, if we're detached from emotions, people can use that for good and bad things, you know. And so the alien invasion is just one aspect of that, you know. It's just exacerbated it, because since then, in this world, enrollment into the program has greatly increased. Because what's the point if we were able to, we were the highest functioning life form on Earth, and what if one day something changes and that's not the case, and now we can be squashed, very simply, like we can squash an ant, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We have no idea what it's like to be beta.
Exactly.
we haven't been that way for. I imagine since the hunter-gatherer days, we didn't feel very alpha, but once we started farming. We thought we could
literally rule the world.
Yeah. We get to change the planet to suit us versus
us changing to
versus
suit.
Us just trying to not get eaten.
So some people can't live in that world. So or don't know how. You don't know how to live in that world. So that
I don't want to get too political, but I think we've seen as of late when people who think they're alphas, when they find out they just have equals, not that they're behind people.
Exactly.
But finding out they're equal to others is more than they can take.
It's they don't know how to process that. It's literally like a foreign concept.
All great sci-fi is metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And this is turning into that. Absolutely.
Very
cool. So, we're developing that. And, you know, the hope is to film it in Portugal, obviously, honestly.
Oh, really? Cool.
Yeah, because Miguel is, like I said, Portuguese. He's there now. He has, you know, he worked on TV before moving to Los Angeles, and he created a couple shows in Portugal. So he has a lot of connections there.
Very cool. So it must be in Lisbon.
Yeah, I think so.
Lisbon's, you know, it's one of those countries where the capital's almost everything.
Yeah. So, and honestly, you know, the indie spirit, trying to do an indie pilot that's in the 50 to 60 minute range here, you know, an hour of television generally costs millions and millions of dollars for network or cable. Doing it indie, it's even if a couple hundred thousand is kind of not realistic to try to scrape together that kind of money. But it's cheaper if we do it in Portugal.
Yeah, in Portugal. Yeah. That's very cool.
I think it's still being English and stuff and some beautiful countryside and things like that. And it's also going to be like, we kind of want the setting. We don't know if it's going to be set in the United States specifically or a country that is just allegory.
Well, and the truth is the Southern Mediterranean is very California anyway.
He said
that. I mean, when you're there, you feel like you're home.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a California native, so yeah.
Yeah, and he said
from Portugal straight over to Turkey, it's like it's kind of the same climate.
Yeah, he said people won't realize that it's not California.
Yeah.
So
thus the spaghetti western was a staple.
Well,
remember because it was couldn't tell it from
you
the,
tell
from the west.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, yeah. So that's that.
That's that. And you said you're writing, pursuing other things. And
yeah, so I'm finishing one TV pilot and going to be starting with the pilot for the – I have it outlined kind of to start writing that.
Yeah. Soon. And then you have that feature that's embryonic that you think you might want to direct.
Yeah, yeah. That it's very personal and close. You know, I'm a gay man. I'm married. But it's about very broadly, because I haven't finalized, you know, some of it's about what does it mean to be masculine, when a medical, like when you get illness that kind of takes away some of that things that you would, otherwise assume define your masculinity. For example, like you get like diagnosed with something that starts taking away your body hair.
Right.
And you know, there are plenty of guys who don't have it, but if you grow up and you have it, you know, full chest hair and things like that, you know, as evolved as you think you are and you don't have gender hang ups and things like that, if you know, what if you start losing that? And it kind of changes the way you perceive not just yourself, but, you know, how masculine you are or aren't. You know.
Yeah, no, and how you feel the world's perceiving you when you go out into it.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think the last few years, you know, a lot of toxic masculinity has very much been, you know, a discussion topic in not just everyday life, but also in stories that we're seeing and reading. You know, I do think exploring what masculinity is an interesting topic. You know, what it means and how we define it. I don't like the phrase soft masculinity. I've heard that. But
that's one of the things, that's one of my pet peeves is toxic masculinity is a real thing. But I feel like so many people mistake that to mean masculinity is toxic, but it's not all masculinity is not toxic.
No,
it's harassment and rape and those things are toxic.
Absolutely. And trying to use it as some kind of, you know, the traits of masculinity as something as a dominant force and an oppressive force. But, you know, there are like, you know, things that we grow up. And I think guys, especially, you know, in America, grow up with there's preconceived notions of this equals masculinity, like you know, sports, aggressive behavior,
being
built. And, you know, we were talking before about those Marvel movies and look at, like, you know, Captain America holding a helicopter in one hand and a building in another. And we see these biceps that are like insane.
Unreal. Yeah.
And these ideas of masculinity, how a body should look and, you know, having, you know, body hair or manscaping and things like that. So, you know, as healthy as you can be, you know, or think you are, when something in life, you know, directly attacks your body, that kind of changes it. And so if these masculine traits, you know, in this story, it's going to be probably like cancer, that then, you know, changes, you know, what if, in this case, to treat the cancer, you have to take testosterone blockers. So, you know, what happens when you've no longer are producing that and your life, you know, your body starts changing as a result. So, yeah.
So that it'll be right up my alley. I'll tell you why later. Sounds.
So yeah, that's the beginning stages of it. So a gay couple who've been together for a while, who are married, and you know,
right. So also you have a relationship dynamic
exactly.
when a partner in a partnership has a change, it's always it's time of stress.
Yeah, absolutely, and a time of reinvention. It's, you know, sometimes you don't want to change, but life happens and so you are either going to have to reinvent and change and find your new normal. Or you're going to implode. So which is it going to be? You know, if you can't control the change, you can't ignore it. And some people do. And I think that's when life crumbles. So
I think you're one of the admirable writers who you're not sitting down going, what's a really commercial kind of idea?
You know what I mean? I wish I did.
Oh, maybe. But what you're doing is you're identifying really human stories and things that interest you and things you would go see. And that's excellent.
Yeah. I mean, right. Like, this will be something that is,
I mean, this is a deep, intelligent story.
Right. I'm going to definitely do everything I can to make it that way and make it look.
Or you can make it a melodrama. Make it all about the heartstrings. Just make me cry for half an hour. I mean, 90 minutes.
Hopefully I'll do both.
Yeah.
Hopefully I'll make it.
And you can.
Yeah. I kind of want to, like, make you think
for
a while.
I mean, you did with They Fall Fast.
Yeah. I did. I kind of like those movies that make you think and then suddenly you're sucker punched and then you're like, I'm crying now.
Yeah.
But I'm also gay, so I like really melodramatic stuff too. So, it depends on my mood. Depends on my mood.
So be it. I love when a film makes me cry. But I think I cry at happiness more than sadness. Like a really touching moment of joy, I think, makes me a little weepier than sadness.
I'm equal to both. When you said that, the scene that popped in is the end of Little Miss Sunshine. And how much I was crying at the end of that because the family came together for each other and they were all dancing that stupid dance at the end.
Yeah, that's a pretty wonderful one.
Yeah, and I was just smiling and crying at that. Yeah. So, yeah.
For me, it's Whale Rider. I don't know if you saw Whale Rider.
I think
I need about half a day after that film to, like, I just have to keep re-adding more fluids because I can't stop crying. I'm almost crying thinking about it, so I'll stop.
Oh, yeah. No, I do. I remember seeing that in the theater going, this is so impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And just a beautiful ending.
Yeah. It's a beautiful movie. Good times. But yeah, I guess I'm attracted to ideas and then find how do I get the emotion, what's the emotional entry into this idea.
And that was Ed McCarthy, who I didn't even mention in the intro, is a super nice guy. God, he's such a good person. All right, so you should watch his film. That's They Fall Fast, and it's in Season 2, Episode 3 of the Discovery Indie Film TV series, which you can watch right now on Amazon Prime Video. Just go to Prime Video, search for Discovery Indie Film, and give it a watch. You can also go to discoveryindiefilm.com and get links. And if you want the social media, if that's your thing, @DIFWINS is the handle for Discovery Indie Film on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And the only things I also have to mention is the Sherman Oaks Film Festival that showed Ed's film. That's every November in Sherman Oaks, California. And you can learn all about that at ShermanOaksFF.com or on social media. It's @ShermanOaksFF. Not too hard to figure that out. And then another festival I program is Film Invasion LA, and that's @FilmInvasionLA on social media, and the website's FilmInvasionLA.com. All right, I think that's all I got for you. Thanks for listening.